Tonight we're going to pick up in the Old Testament. We're going to go through the book of Obadiah. And one of the reasons why I've selected this book is because one of the goals that I have for this new year is to try to get as many books as I can on the internet. And so I'm going to be selecting books on the basis of their length primarily. I know that's not really, especially a spiritual way of doing things, but I really am kind of set myself a goal to try to get more books up on the internet for that purpose. So, and Obadiah is just one chapter. He's one of the minor prophets. He's probably one of the least read books in the Bible, in the Old Testament. It's a book that's not only one of the least read books, it's probably one of the least understood books in the Old Testament. And there's several things about the book of Obadiah that I think are they're pretty significant, because first of all, Obadiah is a prophet that we know nothing about in terms of who he was, in terms of his genealogy, in terms of his parents. We don't know where he was from. We don't know where he was born. We don't even know what year he wrote this book. I mean, there's speculation. Some commentaries or some, students of the Bible or critics of the Bible have said that, that it's probably written before 887 BC. Some say it was around 587 BC. Some say that he was probably a contemporary of Jeremiah because of what Jeremiah predicted in terms of the destruction of Jerusalem from Babylon. And there's just been a lot of speculations. And I think what adds to the mix here is the fact that in the Old Testament, there's at least 10 or 12 Obadiahs, different Obadiahs. So we know who this particular Obadiah is. I personally believe it probably is the same Obadiah that if you read, I believe it's the book of Kings, Elisha. There was a prophet that was known to Elijah, and his name was Obadiah, and he hid 100 prophets of the Lord in a cave from this wicked woman Jezebel and her worthless husband Ahab. Now, I personally believe that that's probably the Obadiah, but nobody can be certain about who this was, okay? Obadiah itself, the name itself means servant of the Lord, and it kind of lives up to his name because he's unknown. He just simply is a messenger from God, and he is out there preaching a particular message. Now, the message that he preaches is very significant because he's preaching a message about the destruction of Edom, E-D-O-M. And he's not the only one who's preached this message. I think that you will find the message that is also found in the book of Malachi. I think Jeremiah hits upon it, and several other prophets preach or prophesied about the destruction of Edom. Now, I'm going to get into just a second who Edom really was, what the nation really was, what it represented, because it's very, very significant. I think it has a lot of spiritual applications for today. Okay, but if you look at this book, even though it's only one chapter, you've got to take it back and look at the history of the Edomites. Now, this is what Obadiah wrote about or prophesied about, was the destruction of Edom. Now, Edom is the nation that grew out of all the descendants of Esau. Okay, they became known as the Edomites. And I just want to read you something from Genesis 25 because it gives us basically an idea or a picture of where this book is taking us. Okay, we go back to the book of Genesis. You don't have to turn there, but in Genesis 25, we are told about Isaac's wife, Rebekah, and she was barren. And she was barren like 20 years. They'd been married 20 years and didn't have any children. Her womb was closed, and Isaac was very bummed out about it. So was Rebekah. And so Isaac went to the Lord, prayed to God that she would be able to conceive. So she finally conceived when Isaac was about 60 years old. Now, let me just read you what it says in Genesis. It says, "And Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife, and because she was barren, and the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her. And she said, 'If this is so, why then am I this way?' So she went to inquire of the Lord." In other words, she was pregnant, and she had twins, and she could tell that these babies inside of her womb were just fighting. They were fighting. They were like cats and dogs, just kicking and punching and strangling each other. And she couldn't figure this out. She said, why is this happening? I mean, she could sense what's going on in her womb. I mean, these children were at war. And so she went to inquire the Lord about it. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, And two people shall be separated from your body, and one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, she, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. And afterwards his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old when he gave birth, when she gave birth to them. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man, living in tents. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And when Jacob had cooked a stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please, let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." Therefore his name is called Edom. Edom means red stuff, or red. But Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I'm about to die, so of what use then is the birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "First swear to me." So he swore to him and sold him his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now, I read that so you get an idea of who Edom is. Edom is basically the descendants of Esau. Edom means red stuff. Mm-hmm. If you look on this map here, if you see this, there's the word Edom up there, okay? And you see Petra or Petra, I don't know, some people pronounce it a little different. That's still in existence today. They go down to this Petra down here. That was the capital of basically Mount Seir, where all the Edomites had their kingdom. And it became a very, very powerful, wealthy, rich kingdom at the time, because there was the trade routes. You could see the trade routes there, the caravan trade routes. They would go right through up through Edom, through Israel, and over to the east, to Babylon, to Assyria, these other places. Well, they would, the Edomites would charge them a tariff for everything they would bring through. So they became extremely wealthy, and they were extremely well fortified. As a matter of fact, Petra, if you look at it, you know, if you look at some of these books today, you can see that the city is still in existence today. It's a whole city, a massive city that's been hewn out of red rock. And that's where they used to live. They were elevated, they were high up, and to get into their fortification, especially Petra, you'd have to go through this narrow walkway through this, through, you know, massive mountains to get there. And sometimes they become so narrow that you can only get through one guy at a time. You couldn't attack these people. You couldn't defeat these people because they lived in these fortifications that made them impregnable. Now, I want you to keep that in mind, because when we read about this destruction of Edom through the prophet of Obadiah, keep something in mind. You can almost substitute the word Edom for America, because there's a parallel. There's a warning. There's a prophecy, okay? The Bible does tell us that all Scripture is given to us for our instruction, for our reproof, for our education, for our understanding, for our insight. And if you look at this, even though this was fulfilled thousands of years ago, this thing has a tremendous application for any nation that thinks it's beyond the reach of destruction. And I think America has gotten a taste this last year when the Twin Towers were attacked on 9/11, that we are not invincible. Like, we've been a nation that for many, many years has been impregnable. Even though we don't live in the clefts of the rock, we have had the Atlantic Ocean on one side, the Pacific Ocean on another. We have been isolated from the rest of the world. We have been we've become invincible because nobody could attack us. But now I think that has been laid to rest, as far as, hey, God has warned us. He has showed us, hey, there's people who are willing to snuff out their own lives to destroy you. And, you know, there's no stopping them. The only thing that's going to stop them is me. And if you despise me, then your help is finished. Keep something in mind. We are told in Samuel, that God specifically told Samuel, "Those who esteem me, those who honor me, I will honor. Those who lightly esteem me or those who despise me, I will lightly esteem or despise." This nation once honored God. There's no question about it. It was founded on God, founded on the Bible, founded on the principles of God, and we've honored God for many, many years. It's only been within the past 30 to 50 years that this nation has done on an about face, and we no longer esteem God. We no longer honor God. Now, right, since September 11th, there's been a lot of God bless America signs. There's been a lot of patriotism that's been going on. A lot of people flying the flags. But do we honor God? Remember what it says in Isaiah, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. And all I can say is, does our nation honor God with our hearts? Or is it just simply our lips? Well, all we have to do is take a look at how we live. Because Jesus himself said, those who obey me, they love me. And you can't honor God without obedience. So when we give God lip service, we got to say, hey, is that really honoring God? What we really need to do is get rid of, you know, our pornography and our abortions and all of these, you know, blasphemous entertainments and all of these things that are so despise God and dishonor him. We've got to change our behavior as a nation. Otherwise, we're just kidding ourselves. Okay, now I went into kind of a long spiel, but you need to get kind of a background of what we're dealing with here, because there's a spiritual parallel. The two children in her womb, Esau and Jacob. Esau represents the flesh. When I'm talking about the flesh, what I mean by the flesh is, we are told in Galatians, what the flesh represents. I think it's in Galatians 5, you know how to turn there. It says, for the whole law is fulfilled in one word, in the statement, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, take care, lest you be consumed by one another. But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not carry out the desires of the flesh. Now, this is what the flesh represents. In a spiritual sense, the children in Rebekah's womb, Esau represented the flesh. Jacob represented the spirit. And he says, for the flesh sets its desire against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, for they are in opposition to one another, so that you may not do the things that you please. But if you are led by the spirit, you are not under the law. Now the deeds of the flesh are evident, which are immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorceries, enmity, strifes, jealousies, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envyings, drunkenness, carousings, and the things like these, of which I have forewarned you, as I have forewarned you, that those who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Now, keep something in mind, okay? When Esau was born, Jacob's holding on to his heel. And they pulled basically both babies out together, one right after the other. But Esau was the firstborn. As a firstborn, he inherited the right to the firstborn, the birthright. The birthright was that, okay, you would get a double portion of the inheritance, but you would also be the spiritual head, the spiritual leader. You would be the priest. You would be the head of your clan, the household. It was a very, very honorable position as the firstborn. Well, Esau despised that. He didn't think there was any importance to that. Mm-hmm. Jacob, even though his name meant supplanter, Jacob was a conniver, a liar, a deceiver. He was always trying to get the upper edge. He was the type of person who was just, he showed that base nature that within us as far as being, the selfish, self-centered person that he was. But there's something about Jacob that made him light years apart from Esau, and that's that Jacob had a heart for God. If you read in the book of Genesis, you will see that Jacob was always building an altar to God. He had a heart for God. He wanted God. He wanted the things of God. He longed for the things of God, even though he was so frail, humanly speaking. God loved him because of his desire, Jacob's desire for him. As a matter of fact, we are told in Malachi, and it's even told in Romans, that God has specifically said about Jacob and Esau, it says, the oracle of the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachi, I have loved you, says the Lord, but you say, how hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, declares the Lord, yet I love Jacob. But I hated Esau, and I have made his mouth a desolation and appointed his inheritance for the jackals of the wilderness. And then in Romans, Paul quotes that from Malachi, saying, hey, that God said this, even though the children hadn't done anything. Well, keep something in mind. God really didn't hate Esau. Remember what Jesus said in terms of hating your mother and your father? He said, unless you hate your mother and your father and your brother and your sister and even your wife and your kids and even yourself, you cannot be my disciple. Well, we know he wasn't preaching a religion of hate. He was just saying that our love for him must be supreme. We are to love our mother and father and all of these other people. but our love for God must be supreme. In other words, God loved Esau, but it was Jacob who he supremely loved, because Jacob had a heart for God. Also, you could go back to Genesis, and it even says that about Jacob and Leah and Rachel. It says, on one hand, that Jacob loved Leah, but then you read a few paragraphs down, it says that God saw that Leah was hated. Well, Leah wasn't hated. Jacob's love for Rachel was so intense and so superior to his love for Leah that it was almost like a hatred in comparison. So all I'm saying here is that God doesn't hate anyone. It was just, if you put everything in perspective, you see that Jacob was highly honored because of Jacob's honoring God constantly. All right, what I want to do is I want to go ahead and read this, and then we'll go back and go through it. But I had to give you that background. Otherwise, I don't think you would know what we're dealing with here. Okay, the book of Obadiah says, in the vision of Obadiah, thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom. When you see Edom, just think of Esau, concerning Esau's descendants. It says, thus saith the Lord. There's literally thousands of times throughout the scripture that it says, thus saith the Lord God says, or a phrase like that. I mean, it says this continually. These aren't my words. These aren't even Obadiah's words. These are God's words. I mean, this is what God has said. I mean, that's the first thing that should grab our attention when you read this, that this is what God has said. This isn't something that man has conjectured or made up fancied himself. This is what God has directly said concerning the Edomites. He says in verse 1, we have heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, arise and let us go against her for battle. Okay, it says we have heard a report from the Lord. Now we're talking about Obadiah is a prophet, but also Jeremiah and several other prophets who had prophesied about the destruction of Edom. And God always will back up what he says on the basis of two or three witnesses. It's just that one prophet, but he will use at least two or three prophets when he's prophesying. In other words, they will confirm what one another says. So when it says that we have heard a report from the Lord, it's just other prophets, along with Obadiah, have heard a report from the Lord. And the report was that there's going to be nations that are going to go up against Edom. This is a report that they heard. And verse 2 says, behold, I will make you small among the nations you are greatly despised. But like I said before we got started, at this particular time, Edom was a very, very powerful nation. They were a very, very wealthy nation. They were an invincible nation as far as man was concerned. But he said he's going to make them very small among the nations. And he says, in verse 3, the arrogance of your heart has deceived you, and you live in the cleft of the rock. Now, here's what happened to these people. They lived in such an impregnable fortress that they were deceived. They just figured, well, there's nobody that can overtake us. There's nobody that can destroy us because we are so well fortified and so well protected. And isn't that, in a sense, the way America has been for some time now? But, you know, God has ways of bringing us down. God has ways of humbling us. All we have to do is look at September 11th of last year, and it was like, you know, what do we see? We see that, there are people that can get into this country and destroy us. And the Bible says very plainly that unless the Lord guards a house or unless the Lord guards a city, the watchmen do no good. In other words, hey, it's God's protection. It doesn't matter, you know, how many nuclear defenses, missiles we have, and it doesn't matter, like with them, how much fortifications they had. When it was time for their judgment, hey, God had a ways of dealing with them. And they were proud. They were, because I said it in verse 3, in the arrogance of your heart has deceived you. That has done it to so many, many nations. And he says, in that verse 3 again, the arrogance of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the cleft of the rocks, in the loftiness of your dwelling place, you say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? Verse 4, though you build like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. I mean, this is a message for us today. Regardless of what we do, if it's time for our judgment, God will bring us down. It doesn't matter where we are or what kind of fortifications we have. I mean, I know we're talking about a nuclear defense shield. Hey, that's all good and well, but again, unless God is protecting this country, there's nothing that's going to protect us, nothing going to save us. And I don't know how this can get through to people's heads, but I'm afraid that we are going to have to suffer a great deal before people wake up and realize that, hey, God is in control. And they have been lulled to sleep with a false sense of security. Well, just like these people were. They were, you know, had a false sense of security about their own invincibility. And in verse 5 it says, if thieves came to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you will be ruined. Would they not steal only until they had enough? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave some gleanings? Oh, how Esau will be ransacked and his hidden treasures searched out. Okay, now what it's saying here is, God is going to so judge these people that there's going to be nothing left. All of their wealth and all their treasure is going to be gone up in smoke. It's going to be gone. Keep something in mind. What made these people so wealthy was, like I said, the camel trade routes that would come from Egypt and other parts of the world up right through Mount Seir. They gave them passage through tariffs, okay? And they became extremely wealthy from all the different wealth from different parts of the world. And all their wealth was in their caves and in their fortifications, in their hewn out cities, in their rocks, everything. They had tremendous wealth. Well, God's saying this, if thieves came to you, they couldn't clean you out totally and completely. In other words, they could only take what they could carry or what they wanted. But he's saying what's going to happen to you is that you're going to be so cleaned out there's going to be nothing left. It's almost like the pyramids. Like the Egyptians built the pyramids, you know, they had in mind that this would be this massive tomb that would hold, you know, all of these treasures that was supposedly going to be for this pharaoh, this king's journey through eternity or whatever. He's going to take all of this with him. Look at the pyramids today. Not only are they crumbling, but they have been broken into by grave robbers, by thieves, by archaeologists, by all of these people throughout the centuries who have robbed them blind. There's nothing left. They've been picked over and over and over and over again like a dead carcass. And this is exactly what happened to the Edomites, is that once they fell, people for centuries have been going back in there and digging up treasure, things that they had buried and things that they had hidden and things were secretly put away. Everything's been turned over. Not one rock has been left unturned as far as the robbers, the thieves, the archaeologists, these people. I mean, this is a total fulfillment of what God had said here. Is that verse 6, oh, Esau will be ransacked and his hidden treasures searched out. And then verse 7, all the men allied with you will send you forth to the border, and the men at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. They who eat your bread will set an ambush for you. There is no understanding in him. Now let's read a little bit further, because I'll explain this verse 7 in just a minute. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy the wise men of Edom and the understanding from the mountain of Esau? Then your mighty men will be dismayed, O Teman, in order that that every one may be cut off from the mountains of Esau by slaughter. Because of violence to your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame, and you will be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that the strangers carried off his wealth, the foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune, and do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster, and do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster, and do not stand at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives, and do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. Now, what he's saying here is that what happened was God had predicted, because Israel was unfaithful to him, he warned them time and time and time again through the prophets that he was going to destroy Jerusalem, that he was going to have this temple destroyed, that the people were going to be carried off away into exile. And so what happened, the fulfillment of Jeremiah and the other prophets was that, you can't see it up on here on the map, you can see Jerusalem, but from the east came Nebuchadnezzar and all his armies. And they came down to Jerusalem. Well, when they came down to Jerusalem to ransack it, to kill and to pillage and to loot and to conquer that city and destroy the temple, they made alliances with these other nations. So they made an alliance with Edom. Mm. And what they said is, okay, we're going to come down there. We're going to destroy Jerusalem. You guys, you cut off anybody, any fugitives that are running away from us. Turn them over to us. And so what happened was when Nebuchadnezzar came down to Jerusalem, a lot of the people, Israelites, try to flee. And they try to flee towards the south. Well, what's happened is the Edomites were cutting him off at the forks of the road. They would either cut him down, they would pillage their loot, or they would take him prisoner and turn him over to Nebuchadnezzar. So, but keep something in mind. These were brothers. Mm-hmm. The Edomites and the Israelites were brothers. They were related. And this is one of the things that God hates. He tells us in Proverbs that there are seven things that God hates. And one of the things that God hates is those who stir up discord among brothers. Now, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but look at what's happening in Israel today. Israel and the Palestinians and the Arabs. The Arabs and the Israelis are brothers. Abraham was the father of Ishmael. And he became the father of 12 sons. And they became the father of all the Arab nations, Ishmael. And of course, Ishmael's brother, half-brother, was Isaac. So they are related. They're brothers. But look at them today. They are like the Palestinians who hate Israel. Mm-hmm. They hate them. The Arabs hate their own brother. And this is something that really, really angers God. They want to see Israel absolutely destroyed. And they are out there killing themselves in order to kill them. It's just pure hate. Well, you've seen the same kind of hatred here that was manifested by the Edomites towards the Israelites when the Israel was being overrun by Babylon. But here's the thing. What happened there was that their treachery turned on the 180 degree around and came on their head. Because what happened was that Nebuchadnezzar's armies told, after they had finished destroying the Israelites, they told the armies of the Edomites, come and meet us at the borders. That's what he's saying here. Look what he's saying here at verse 7. All the men allied with you will send you forth to the border, and the men at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. They who eat your bread will set an ambush for you. There is no understanding in him, meaning Edom. So they got their armies out of the fortification. They said, okay, we're allied with you. Come on out and meet us at the border. We'll divide up the spoil. When they got out there, Nebuchadnezzar turned on them and destroyed their armies. Oh, right there. See, that was a judgment from God. And what it says here is that there is no understanding in him, meaning Edom. Mm. But at one time, they were referred to as a very intelligent people, a very progressive people. As a matter of fact, Teman is the grandson of Esau. And if you look at the book of Job, Eliphaz was one of the wise men speaking to Job, and he was from Teman. Mm-hmm. They were noted for their intelligence and for their ingenuity, for their inventions. They were really an advanced civilization. Mm-hmm. Look at this country today. We have been on the cutting edge of technology and inventions, and I mean the world over. I mean the United States has really, really been light years ahead of other nations because we had honored God. Look at us today. It says here, as far as what happened to Esau, in that last part of that verse 7 in parentheses, there is no understanding in him. Look at what's happening to our nation today. 50 years ago or 100 years ago, people come to this country, they went to Ellis Island in New York, and it was expected that people learn a language and be assimilated into our culture and become part of America, become Americans. Now we're becoming balkanized. People don't want to learn English. We were once at the forefront in the world as far as cutting technology and as far as our education. Now you got every westernized nation on earth, I don't care whether it's France or Japan or Germany or Italy, all these nations are far above us as far as our national education is concerned. We come in dead last on every testing in terms of science or biology or math, language, things like that. We are dead last. We've got 2 million kids a year graduating from our high schools that are functionally illiterate. We've got almost 90 million people in this country that are functionally illiterate. Why is this happening? It is a judgment from God. God told Israel, look, if you obey me, you follow my instructions, you do what I ask, you love me, I will bless you. You disobey me, you start worshiping other gods, you get into idol worship, you start disdaining my statutes, my ordinances, my laws, and my commandments, he says, I'm going to have the alien rule over you. You are no longer going to be the head, you're going to be the tail. And anybody with spiritual insight can see that this is happening to America. Even though we've got this unification right now because of what happened on September 11th, you can still see that we're not making the changes we need to make. Why? Because in our government, our leadership, common sense is about the most uncommon thing there is. And anybody who shows any common sense is immediately lambasted as being hateful, as being bigoted, as being narrow-minded, as being a dangerous. I mean, this is the way the media is, right? I mean, all you have to do is take a look at the New York Times yesterday's or today's. You know, they were showing things about this past year. And just the way the captions are, you know, they have big, huge picture of, let's say, some Palestinians running, you know, at a funeral in fear of being attacked. But who's doing all the attacking? Everything's shown one-sided. Everything's so biased. Everything is so distorted. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's books out called, like, the Coloring of the News or A Biased, things like this that are just showing that, hey, so much of what's being pushed down people's throats today is an agenda. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't think that the media is biased, you know, you really have to be living on the moon because they are extremely biased on issues like what? Abortion, homosexuality, immigration, and the list goes on and on. You can see their bias in everything.
But moral values.
Who's in control of the media? It's demonic forces. Because we are told that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but these spiritual forces of wickedness in high places. Mm-hmm. And it's scary, isn't it? But that's what happened to Edom. Is they were once a very, very advanced civilization. But they became proud, they became arrogant, they became boastful. Hey, and when it was their time, God just pulled them out of their hole and just dealt with them. But their armies were destroyed. But they as a people weren't totally annihilated. Because they lived on for centuries. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, you go all the way down to King Herod in Jesus' day. Now, I know there were several King Herods. There were like Herod Agrippa, there was Herod the Great, and there was several other Herods that are mentioned in the Bible, but there's also Herod the Edomian. Edomian meant the Edomite. Mm. Who was that Herod? Remember when Jesus was sent to Pilate, and he's standing before Pilate, and Pilate finds out that Jesus is a Galilean? He says, oh man, he's a Galilean. He thought he was going to get off the hook. He says, hey, well, Herod's here in town for all the ceremonies. They send him to Herod. They send him to Herod. Herod is an Edomite. He goes to Herod. He stands before Herod. And Herod's there mocking Jesus. And he wanted to see Jesus. He was enthused about seeing Jesus. He said, hey, man, show me a miracle, man. Do something. I heard all about you. Show me. Do something. Do a trick. Do a miracle. Okay. Jesus stood there and said nothing and did nothing until Herod just got fed up and just mocked him, ridiculed him, put a expensive purple robe on him and says, get him out of here. Get him back to Pilate. That was the last mention of an Edomite in the Bible. It came all the way down from Jacob and Esau in the womb of Rebekah, two lines all the way down to Jesus at his trial between Herod and Jesus. And then the last of the Edomites were destroyed in 70 AD when the Roman commander Titus destroyed Jerusalem and incarcerated away the Jews. The remaining few Edomites that were left were destroyed. You ever see an Edomite today? Mm-hmm. A Babylonian today, a Hittite today, a Pezerite today, a Jezebite? I mean, all these nations that were once much stronger than Israel are no longer in existence. And that's exactly what it being said here. And they were destroyed because of what? Because of what they did. They turned on their brothers. They were deceitful to their brothers. They cut them down. They jumped in with the invading armies of Babylon to destroy Israel when they should have at least done their best to protect them because they were brothers. Instead, they turned on them. I'm going to tell you something. There are Edomites in the church today. Even though the Edomites are no longer in existence, spiritually speaking, there are Edomites within the church. And what I mean by that is that we are told in Hebrews, see to it that there is no immoral or godless person among you, the church, Christians, who sell their birthright for a mess of porridge. And how many Edomites are in the church today who sell out their birthright to Christ for what? The things of the world, or they turn on their brothers. You know, or they cause discord and dissension within the church. See what I'm saying? So spiritually speaking, there's still the fight goes on. The struggle still goes on. But the Edomites, as far as physically, as far as the nation, they are no longer in existence. Okay, let's just wind this down. He says in verse 15, he says, "For the day of the Lord draws near on all nations, as you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head." This is poetic justice. God's poetic justice. He's telling that basically there's a judgment day that's drawing upon all nations. No nation will escape his judgment. We're all going to have to experience the judgment of God, you know, good or bad. But look what he says, "As you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head." Now, this is who he's referring here to, Edom and the Edomites. Okay, they were treacherous to their brothers. What happened? The Babylonians were treacherous to them. Mm-hmm. Right? But, take for example, what's happening in this country as far as abortions. Since 1973, there's been over 40 million children murdered in this country. Mm-hmm. It says here, "As you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return upon your own head." And that's a pretty frightful thing when you think that God is just and what this nation has done to its unborn. And in verse 16, because just as you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and swallow and become as if they had never existed. In other words, every nation is going to have to drink of his wrath. And there's going to be a number of nations that are going to be annihilated. Like I said, if you look back on history, you won't find an Edomite today. You won't find a Babylonian today. You won't find a Hezrite, a Hittite, a Pezerite. All these other nations that were once more powerful than Israel, that were Israel's enemies, they're no longer in existence. And it says, but verse 17 says, "But on Mount Zion there will be those who escape, and it will be holy, and the house of Jacob will possess their possessions." But in other words, basically saying that the ones who are going to escape are the ones who are solidly committed to God and His laws. Mount Zion, they are with Him. They are committed to Him. And verse 18 says, "Then the house of Jacob will be a fire and the house of Joseph a flame, but the house of Esau will be stubble." In other words, God is going to use Israel, the house of Jacob and the house of Joseph. They're going to be a fire and a flame. I think He's going to, there's a reference here, or an implication here, that He's going to use them to judge the world. There'll be a fire and a flame. And we are told in Zechariah that in the last days, Israel will become a burdensome stone to the whole world. You can hardly pick up a newspaper or look at the news without seeing Israel being in it. Yeah. And they're becoming more and more of a burdensome stone to the whole world. The world wants to take this stone and cast it into the sea. Mm-hmm. Be done with it. But God is going to use them to judge the nations. Because at the very end, all the nations are going to be down there in Israel, and that's where God is going to judge the nations. And He says that, but Esau will be a stubble. In other words, he'll be totally insignificant. And in that latter part of verse 18, "And they will set them on the fire and consume them, so that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken." Like I said, there's no more Edomites today. Last mention of an Edomite was Herod dealing with Jesus. That's the last of it. Verse 19, "Then those of the Negev," and the Negev is down in this area here, the Edomite area is referred to as the Negev. "Then those of the Negev will possess the mountains of Esau, and those of the Shephland of the Philistine plain, and they will possess the territory of Ephraim and the territory of Samaria, and Benjamin will possess Gilead, and the exiles of the host of the sons of Israel, who are among the Canaanites as far as Zepharath, and the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Shephard, will possess the cities of the Negev. The deliverers will ascend Mount Zion, to judge the mountain of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's." In other words, what he's saying is that Esau, the Edomites, are going to be extinguished. They're going to be no more as a nation. You're not even going to hear about them again. But Israel is going to expand her territories. You know, at Israel's zenith, at their very, very most powerful time in their nation's history, which was under David and Solomon, they only possessed like 30,000 square miles of land. But God had promised them upwards of like 300,000 square miles of land he promised them to Abraham. Well, there's going to come a day when Israel is finally going to have its borders that God had promised them. And that borders are going to be really expanded. Right now, they are just really, you know, reduced as far as their possession of the land that they have. And they're losing more and more because of all these stupid treaties that are going on. But when Christ comes back, sets its millennial kingdom, they will finally receive the land that God had promised Abraham. And so in other words, he's saying that Edom is going to be reduced to nothing. Israel is going to really become a great nation in spite of the fact that they've been, you know, severely chastised. Anybody have anyone to add or share?
No.